This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's a question humans have asked since time immemorial. What happens after we die? For people who've had near-death experiences, the answer becomes a little more clear. Many of them report feeling unconditional love, complete understanding, or perfect calm as their physical bodies hovered between life and death. Plenty of people are eager to dismiss these accounts, but a small number of scientists have dedicated years to examining the phenomenon of near-death experiences and trying to figure out what they tell us about our brains and consciousness. One of them is Dr. Bruce Grayson. He's a professor emeritus of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia Health System, also former director of its Division of Perceptual Studies. Welcome, Bruce Grayson.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Good to have you. And Susan Amsden is here as well. She's the Durham Group Leader and Business Manager for the International Association for Near-Death Studies. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask you both, and I'll start with you, Bruce, how you got interested in this subject.
Well, I've always been trained as a scientist and following the data where the data lead us. And in my work in psychiatry, I found some phenomena that could not be explained by the models we were using to explain mind and brain. Things like mystical experiences, like near-death experiences, things where people's brains seemed to be going offline when their brains weren't functioning, and yet they were thinking faster and clearer than ever. So I started pursuing these phenomena to try to understand mind and brain in everybody.
Susan, what about you?
Well, my mother died when I was a child of pancreatic cancer, and that really started me on all the questions of life. I mean, what's the purpose of life? Why are we here? And I felt like I was very different from other children because I'm on the recess playground, you know, thinking these thoughts, and nobody else, the other children, didn't seem to be. So when I found IANs and learned about near-death experiences, I found they had a lot of answers for me.
What kind of answers? What did it tell you right off the bat?
Well, in how they change their lives after they have their life review, I found that very fascinating. And many of them, they even saw some past lives and some future lives, which they say that time is different over there. It's all happening in the now.
Bruce Grayson, what are we talking about? When I say near-death experience, I think everybody will somehow have an image and an impression of what I'm talking about. But how do you define it?
That's right. Well, everybody has some idea of it, but basically a near-death experience is something that happens to about 15 or 20% of people who come close to death or are pronounced dead that has a profound effect on their lives. Their thinking is clearer and faster than ever before. They have feelings of tremendous peace and well-being. They may see their life flash before them. They often have a sense of leaving their physical bodies, a so-called out-of-body experience. They may meet deceased loved ones and other beings that appear to be spiritual beings, and when they come back to this life, they are forever changed by that experience. They have different attitudes, beliefs, values, behavior.
How much scientific research has been done on this, just in terms of statistics? In other words, how many of these experiences are common? What does everybody experience, and where are the differences? Do we even know that much yet?
We do. We've been studying these experiences for about 40 years now. And there's actually a journal, the Journal of Near-Death Studies, which has been going for about 30 years. But now more and more studies of near-death experiences are being published in major mainstream medical journals. And there have been studies conducted on all continents except Antarctica about near-death experiences. We've been looking at cross-cultural studies. The main thing the most profound thing that we see are the profound changes in people's lives after the experience. No matter what you think causes the experience, people are never the same after it.
So, Susan, something is happening. Something happened, right? And what happened is still a question, but something happened.
Yes, definitely. And I didn't learn until 40 years later that my mother had a near-death experience. So I don't think it's an accident that I'm working for the International Association for Near-Death
Studies. How did you learn that, and what did you know? What did you find out about it?
Well, my brother happened to be talking to me. Well, I told him that I was so interested in these experiences. I learned so much about how to live my life better. And he said, well, don't you remember our mother had one before she died? And I said, no, I don't remember her telling us. He said, yeah, she was floating up near the hospital room ceiling, looking down at her body, watching the doctors trying to restart her heart. And then all of a sudden it dawned on her, wait a minute, how can I be out of my body looking down at myself? Well, she died about 2 months later, but that was in 1964, before Dr. Raymond Moody ever wrote his book, Life After Life, so she hadn't read it anywhere.
How much, Dr. Grayson, let me ask you, how often, what percentage of the time, there is this out-of-body experience, the sense of seeing your body from a different location?
It occurs in about 30% of people who have a near-death experience. Often people just have a sense of watching the scene from above. They may report accurate things that are very surprising to them, like a nurse having mismatched shoelaces, things that they couldn't have guessed.
So again, let me stop you there. Often some verifiable, details in the room, things that they would have seen and others would agree, yeah, that was actually there.
Right. Dr. Jan Holden at the University of North Texas actually studied 93 of these cases of people who reported leaving their bodies and watching what was going on. And she found that in these almost 100 cases, 92% were entirely accurate. 7% had some errors, were but mostly accurate, and only 1% were flat out wrong.
Susan, in your organization, tell us what you're hearing from people about what they experience beyond just being able to sort of see themselves from this other perspective, the sensation they have, the feeling of often calm, peace. Tell us about those feelings.
Oh, yeah. It's wonderful. I mean, it does take them a while. The research shows about 7.5 years to actually sort it out and integrate it into their lives because they feel like they have one foot in the other realm and one foot in this world, and they're trying to, you know, do the best that they can. But I did want to mention there was a landmark case called dealing with Pamela Reynolds, where she had veridical evidence. They had to cool her body down to 60 degrees, stop her heart because she had an aneurysm at the base of her brain. And what she realized and saw in her out-of-body experience was they switched legs on the veins, and they had she actually saw the saw that they had cut her skull with, which she said looked like an electric toothbrush. And she had an experience where she visited her deceased grandmother and uncle. So there were several items there that were veridical in her case.
Now, in terms of what's going on, Bruce Grayson, what do we think is happening here? Because, again, there is an experience of something that people report. So something happened. What do you think is going on?
Actually, I have no idea what's going on. I've been studying this only for 40 years.
I'll give you some time.
You're right. There have been a number of physiological explanations that have been proposed to explain this, such as lack of oxygen to the brain, too much carbon dioxide, activity of the temporal lobe. And when we've been able to test some of these theories, the data have been disproving every one of them. We have no explanation. But beyond the details of specific explanations, the underlying point is we have no idea how a physical event in the brain, an electrical pulse or a chemical change, can produce a thought or a feeling. There's just no explanation for how you can get a mental activity out of a physical event. And then you have things like near-death experiences where the brain is totally shut down, and yet people are thinking clearer than ever.
Right, and the totally shut down is by whatever means we measure. So perhaps exactly. we don't have the measurement that's keen enough to get down to the point that there's actually stuff going on and we just don't know it. So that's one thing that might be happening, true.
That's a possibility, but we know pretty well from EEG studies, brainwave studies, what it takes for a brain to be functioning normally. And we have evidence of people whose brains were not functioning in those ways and yet seem to have clear consciousness.
Susan, what do people who've had these experiences, what do they make of it? I'm sure there are a variety of explanations that they have. Give us an idea.
Well, what I notice is a lot of experiencers, they really don't need the researchers to tell them that it was a valid experience. They know it is, but it's very difficult for them to talk to people about it. And the statistics show that there's about for every 1 in 20 people, they've had a near-death experience. And when you think about every 20 people you know, how come they haven't felt comfortable in telling you their experience, that type of thing?
But and apart from the verifiable kind of physical details, things I saw, talk about these feelings, these sensations of peace and calm and unconditional love, these kinds of things.
Oh, yes. They tell us that very much. You know, that's very common. They also tell us that there are colors there that we don't have here. Things are so vibrant, vivid. But yeah, that unconditional love, they say they just have not experienced that like they have on Earth here. That, yeah, it's so wonderful.
So Dr. Grayson, let's talk about this, because you said we can't even explain how the physical and the chemical and electrical activity in the nervous system produces something like a thought or a feeling. We don't have a good explanation for that. We still don't know what consciousness is or how it works, and none of us would say, therefore, there is no such thing. So isn't it possible that when in extremis like this, when our nervous system is in an extreme condition and shutting down, that there are, because after all, look, the nervous system is a kind of hallucination machine, right? We take all this information, encode it, decode it, and come up with structures that you know, sort of our representations in our head. You do something to that process and you're going to come up with a very different representation. So why would this be so hard to understand just in terms of normal processes?
Well, it's certainly plausible that the brain would hallucinate when it starts shutting down. The problem with that is in near-death experiences, you have not hallucinations but accurate perceptions of things we can verify by talking to other people who are in the room. And hallucinations are usually not accurate perceptions of things going on. Furthermore, people who hallucinate don't change their lives for decades after based on the things they hallucinated. These people are experiencing something that they feel is hyper-real. It's more real than this reality, and they change their lives by it.
Well, I would have to challenge that a little bit. I mean, we know, at least from based on LSD experiments, there are people who have taken acid, and it has forever changed them. That what they saw there, and they would tell you they understand it was all happening in their minds, but that they had sensations and feelings that forever changed the way they approached their art, their craft, and their lives. I mean, we do
have those
reports.
That's right. And we always assumed that what the LSD was doing was stimulating the brain to hallucinate. But recent neuroimaging studies done at Johns Hopkins University and in the United Kingdom have shown just the opposite. In fact, when you take LSD or psilocybin, you see the brain shutting down and the connections between different parts of the brain start shutting down. So what seems to be happening is these drugs get the brain out of the way so you can go ahead and experience things.
That leads me to the next question, Susan, this getting the brain out of the way. Much of what people who have had a near-death experience report sounds very similar to what the mystical teachers have been talking about for millennia, and that is getting the brain out of the way, getting the ego out of the way, essentially letting go. And isn't shutting down the autonomic nervous system, getting it to that point, the ultimate in letting go? And then, for some reason, come back and remember the experience. Could it not be roughly the same thing that mystics and yogis try to do so hard? Get my ego out of the way.
Oh, yeah. I definitely think that's the case. I mean, we come here with a personality and, many of them are able to let that go. It's almost like some of them say they feel like their minds kind of got rewired. But, yeah, there's a lot of amazing things that happen. And say I'll give the example of Dave Bennett. He drowned when they were testing $1.5 million submarine. And he was shown that he was going to die of cancer. But, I mean, that his doctor would say that, but that he knew he was going to be fine. Well, there's no way he could have known that information, but 10 years later that actually started playing out. A doctor was saying, you have cancer, you might as well get your affairs in order, you got about 6 weeks, and he was fine. I mean, through things that he did, he knew he was going to be okay, and I think he's 50 years past that now.
And you have other examples, too. There's an example of a man who was struck by lightning.
Yeah, Dr. story. Anthony Sicoria from New York. He was out in a park at a family reunion. He went to call his mother on an outside phone. Lightning struck. He saw the blue flash, hit the phone, and he felt himself moving backwards. And then all of a sudden, he was a little confused because he was moving forwards. But his consciousness never stopped. He said he was always thinking, and he didn't even realize till he saw his mother-in-law come screaming towards him. But he saw her run past him, and he turned around to look, and here his body's laying on the ground. He's like, oh, let's say bleep. I have to say bleep, I guess. Oh, bleep, yeah. I'm dead. So, his consciousness was still working, so it's very encouraging for us.
What about this Bruce Grayson, that a near-death experience, that level of shutdown is the ultimate in letting go, and it's what the mystics have been trying to do for years, although they would say, let's try to do that and not be put ourselves in mortal danger.
Right. I think you're right. I think that the near-death experience or coming close to death is only one way of having this type of mystical experience. It may be the most reliable way we have. But if you look at some of the ancient civilizations' ways of producing mystical experiences, they were basically inducing near-death experiences, whether it was by taking poisons or, as the ancient Egyptians, they would actually bury you in a casket underground for a while, trying to basically bring you close to death so you would have this near-death experience.
Some of this happens, too, in meditation and other other practice, Susan, ascetic practices, again, letting go, denying yourself and not attaching yourselves. And this all seems to be at least correlated to what happens here.
Yes. And when I started asking near-death experiencers, how can I feel that unconditional love or how can I hear that divine wisdom? It was unanimous. They all said meditation. That's what they recommended. So since then that I've done that, I have had some experiences myself.
What about this? You talked about taking 7 years or so, even more, to integrate this. How do people cope with it, the sense that they've been there? They've sensed this oneness. They understand it's all about universal love and not about separating myself and the kinds of mayhem that our egos create. But then we still have to live here. So now what? How do they integrate all this?
Yeah, well, that's why we provide support groups around the United States and groups in other countries to help them integrate it. But everyone is welcome to come to those groups. We also provide an annual conference that everyone's welcome to also. We had 350 last conference, and we had over 70 speakers talking about these kinds of experiences. But yes, it is a challenge for them. Some of them do get depressed or maybe even angry, you know, at the nurse who's brought them back because they wanted to stay there. It was so wonderful. But they realize that we're all here for a purpose, even if we have no idea what it is, and that, you know, we will go back. And it'll be like removing an overcoat and walking through a doorway.
Yeah, the everything's okay part of it is hard to live with. Because everything in our social order, right, is telling us, no, it's not good enough yet. No, work a little bit harder, make a little bit more money, buy yet. Now let's get iPhone 37.
Yeah.
That's got to be better than iPhone 36. It has to be.
Yeah, definitely. They're less materialistic when they come back.
I would
back.
Think so. Yeah. Bruce Grace, what about the research into this? Are we taking it seriously enough? As you say, at the very least, something has happened here. Do we spend enough time figuring out what's going on?
I think we are. It's been a gradual process over the last 40 years getting people to take this seriously, but I think we are making tremendous progress here. And what's making the difference, I think, is seeing the impact on people's lives, that it really is changing how people live. You know, if someone has been a very loving person before the experience, they may not change all that much. But if they're a hard-driven business person or if they're in a violent profession, for example, a police officer or a career military person, they may find that they can't go back to their old professions anymore. And that's tremendously disrupting to them. And they do require a lot of support sometimes.
It seems to me that some of the resistance to this is the belief that if I accept this, I will also automatically accept an afterlife and other kinds of religious principles. But that's really not necessary, is it, to believe in an afterlife to know that near death, that something profound has happened here?
It's not necessary. Most near-death experiences do believe without a question that there is an afterlife. But I think what these do show is that the mind and the brain aren't the same thing. And there are times when the mind can continue functioning without the brain, at least for a while. You know, the near-death experiences do not show that the mind lasts forever because we don't study people forever. But it does show that it lasts after the brain goes offline.
I want to thank you both for being on our program. Dr. Bruce Grayson is Carlson Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences and the former director of the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia Health System. And Susan Amsden is the Durham Group Leader and Business Manager for the International Association of Near-Death Studies. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
You can find out more about their work and their associations at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we preview a new podcast that explores the music of Durham-based band The Mountain Goats and the creative experience. All that just ahead on The State of Things.